The Far Side of the Moon, Trials of My Father, of one of our leading campaigners for justice, human rights lawyer Clive Stafford Smith, has spent a lifetime getting to know his clients, from detainees in Guantanamo Bay to prisoners facing execution on death row, finding out, in his own words, what makes them tick. But for most of his life, close to his home, there's a man whose mind remained off limits. His own father. The Far Side of the Moon, Trials of My Father, looks at a son's rediscovery of his father. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, Clive Stafford Smith. Good morning to you, Clive.
Oh, good morning. I'm from deepest Dorset, and I'm not sure I'm willing to talk to you if you couldn't get Vic Marks to play for my cricket team. Come on,
deep Dorset. I didn't know this entire interview was going to hang on that. Do you see? That's the trials and tribulations of broadcast radio. Now, Vic tells me this show is turning has become incredibly interactive, because as soon as you sent that email off to me in the studio, I asked Vic. He said he couldn't do it. Now you don't want to come on. I mean, I think we should all just go to the West Country and watch some cricket. How about that, Clive? What do you think is that?
Yeah, very, very good idea. The hell with human rights. Let's just focus on cricket.
Tell me a little bit, Clive, about, because we know the work that you do. We know how you, in your own words, you visit people in, should we say, extraordinary circumstances and find out what makes them tick, Guantanamo, death row, etc. And yet it's very easy to, and this is a layman's point of view, it's very easy to extrapolate and think, okay, well, this is obviously this person thinks this because this has happened to them before and that set of circumstances. But when it's closer to home, when it's somebody that you think you know or try to get to know and weren't able to, it is perhaps a little different. Give me a bit of background, if you would, about your father.
Well, I mean, look, it was actually, I wrote this book because I sort of failed dad in his lifetime. Because my brother and sister and I all left the country pretty much as soon as we could. I was the youngest and I went first, because my father was very, very difficult. And I spent, you know, this book began as a sort of parallel life between dad and one of my clients, Larry Lonchar, who also suffered from what's referred to as bipolar disorder. And I don't like those labels. And so, you know, what I wanted to do to begin with was look at how America treated Larry. They put him on death row and executed him in the electric chair, versus how Britain treated my dad, which by and large, they were pretty gentle with him. But, you know, then what I found I needed to do more was, you know, when you talk about what we refer to as mental illness, another phrase I dislike a lot, and you're trying to destigmatize it, it's, you know, you tell stories. I'll tell you one story about my dad and it'll immediately stigmatize him. When I was 7, dad sat me down and said, you know, when I was 16, I was bombing Germany. You're very naive. Time for you to grow up. Here's 200 quid. Now buzz off and go live by yourself. You know, and dad would do things like that. But that doesn't exactly destigmatize him, does it? It did slightly shock me at the time. I wasn't quite sure what he meant by compound interest. But so in the end, I ended up having to do a whole bunch of stuff that also looked at my own idiosyncrasies, of which there are many. I'm afraid you won't be able to pigeonhole me very easily because there's just too many of my disorders. But I think it's really important to talk about these things so that we can help get past the labels and to the individuals.
But perhaps this is one of the crux, one of the problems, the fact that we look for quick solutions, we look for easy answers, we look for easy labels, so that we can say, oh, well, that's what's up, that's what we do, that's how we treat them, we give them this, we give them that, and job done.
Which is just mad, right? If ever there was a mad thing. And, you know, when you look at dad, I'll give you a very brief potted history of him, because I think it illustrates the point. So, you know, when he was very young, he sent off to bomb Germany when he's still a teenager. And it had a big psychological impact on him. He goes through school where his careers advisors, they give him 5 possibilities of his job, 3 of which were factory inspector. I mean, I just don't think these people had ever met my dad. My dad was very, very brilliant, but he did become very, very manic quite a lot. And so he ends up in this job. His father had inherited a stud, a wonderful stud farm in Newmarket from this chap called Robert Sherwood. And I worked out much, much later that actually my granddad, my family wouldn't admit he was Jewish until I was about 30. But then it turns out he was also having a gay affair with the guy who left him the stud. So my family suddenly becomes nouveau riche in that generation. And then he dies and my dad gets it. And my dad is now gambling with horses, the very quintessential job that one shouldn't do if you're of the personality that my dad had. So he bankrupted all of that and caused all sorts of misery to lots of people. And so what I was trying to explore was how could my dad have had a much, much happier life, which would have made it much happier for those of us around him too. But I didn't do that when he was alive. I did it after he was dead. I did that for an awful lot of prisoners who I was representing, but not my dad. And I feel really guilty about that. It's really bad.
I mean, could you draw the similarities then between the people that you were seeing, you were interviewing, you were working for on something like a death row, and this particular prisoner, Larry yeah, who you draw a parallel with? I mean, at the time, did you think this is perhaps mirroring my own father's state of mind at the moment?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, Larry was much more depressed than he was manic, as opposed to Dad, who was manic most of the time and only depressed a few times. And when he's on death row, and he's on death row for something, clearly he didn't do what they said he did. Now, exactly what he did do is a different question. But Larry lived such a miserable life that he constantly tried to commit suicide by electric chair. And, you know, people used to get annoyed at me because I'm representing this guy who wants to die and trying to stop it. It was really actually very difficult to work out what your duty was. But Larry and I came within 40 minutes of his execution four times. Once we came within 58 seconds of him being electrocuted before the US Supreme Court stepped in and stopped it. And it was pretty traumatic for me, let alone him. And so the state of Georgia wouldn't treat him when he was trying to kill himself because they wanted him to die. And so there's this extraordinary thing that we're going through. But of course I knew it was like Dad because Larry would push all my buttons, you know, everything that any human being could do to make me lose it, Larry could do. Yeah.
I think that springs to mind. You just said that they came within 40 minutes, and then you said it came within 58. And excuse me for seconds. Excuse me for going off on a tangent here. But when you get that message, is it because, thankfully, most of us will only ever think of these situations as in a Hollywood movie. There's somebody literally running with a piece of paper saying, stop, we've got a reprieve from the governor.
No, I was on the phone to the US Supreme Court clerk, nice chap. And, you know, he says, oh, give me a minute. I need a couple of minutes. I say, we don't have a couple of minutes. And it's on the phone now. Now, there was a time when it was where you had to fax stuff to the US Supreme Court. And there was one guy who, you know, almost got executed when the Supreme Court fax machine didn't work. So there are these, it's not quite running in with a bit of paper, but there definitely are those moments when the red telephone rings and you get on it and you hope it's a stay, not a go, you know?
So what was the parallels between Larry and your father? They also bring parallels between how the UK treats people who have these problems as opposed to perhaps the American approach.
Well, I mean, there are different ways. I don't think any of us treats, any country treats it, someone like my dad very well. But my dad was in England for a long time till he bankrupted everything. He fled his creditors to right around where you are in Spain. He was there for years until he annoyed the king so much that he got kicked out of there again. So, and then he was only ever locked up for a couple of days for doing something stupid, you know, not paying bills of hotels that he went into where he spent too much money that he didn't have. But nevertheless, Larry was, my father was ostracized from everyone because, you know, he would just annoy everyone so much that they didn't want to deal with him. And the poor chap was in this cycle where the more he alienated people, the more alienated he was, and the more angry and he would get, and the worse he'd behave. Larry, on the other hand, was in America, and Larry had a very similar background in the sense that, you know, he got hit on the head by a car just the same way my dad did, which might have had a significant impact on him. But then he was institutionalized the same way my dad was very early on. My dad was in, you know, private school and then the military, and Larry was in, you know, Borstal. And there was an awful lot of similarities in our family background. In the history, my family has a fabulous history of what we'd call mental disorders, and so did Larry. So there's a lot of stuff going in parallel. But Larry in America was living in a society that was not in the least sympathetic. And when his mother ended up being sectioned, you know, committed to a mental hospital, you know, there's no one there to look after Larry. And he ends up getting in more and more trouble. And in the end, Larry, the only place he could survive was really in prison. So, and then he ends up on death row, and then they kill the poor guy. So he was not treated with anything like the sympathy that my father was.
And the book is described as a reflection, if you like, on institutions. Institutions. Now, when you say institutions to many people, they think, you know, prisons, they think of, you know, psychiatric facilities. But obviously institutions also mean the army, public schools, you know, the legal profession could do, you know, the great institutions of the UK. I mean, what are your thoughts then about being, if you like, institutionalized or you know, your life going down a predetermined set of morals?
Well, the nonprofit I've set up now is about helping young people figure out what their element is, meaning what their passion is, where it meets their talents. And I think we just don't do that for young people. And when you look at institutionalization and our own sort of mental idiosyncrasies, you know, let me tell you one of mine. I was institutionalized, you know, when I was just 8 years old, when my parents sent me away to boarding school. And this is a unique madness amongst English people, really. I mean, we have foisted it on certain colonial places around the world. But you talk to most people there in Spain, and they're going to think if you send your kids away to boarding school at 7 or 8, you know, you just must hate children. I had no idea of the psychological impact of that on me, that, you know, here am I thinking that love and emotion is all about your teddy bears and your dog and your family and whatever. And my mom and dad are telling me that love is about sending you away to some institution. And when you're that age, inevitably you, in between weeping every night in boarding school, you think your parents are right. So what you do is you dissociate your emotions. Now, you know, this has happened to a lot of people. You look at the government right now, there's quite a lot of them there in the cabinet. I was incredibly, this is the real point of the book I was trying to get to, was what could I have done to make my father's life fit his idiosyncrasies? And looking back on it, I was astoundingly lucky that I was put through this system that actually did mess me up in all sorts of ways. I should have a little government health warning on my forehead saying, you know, watch out for this person, he doesn't do emotions. But what that allowed me to do, I used to think when people had to go with their clients into the chamber and watch them die in front of you, that a lot of lawyers would come out and be burned out, and this would have a terribly traumatic effect on them. And don't get me wrong, it's a horrible, horrible thing. But I can deal with it because I was taught to deal with it at a very young age, that you dissociate and you just, you know, you take your whole psychology away from it. And in that sense, I think I was immensely lucky that I somehow fell into a slightly bizarre niche profession that actually fit some of my screwed upness. My dad didn't. And so I, looking back on it, what I was trying to figure out is how can we look at all of the different people and instead of stigmatizing them with this label and that label, we look at them and say, well, who is this person? And how can we fit the world to them as opposed to fit them to the world? Because you could never fit my dad to the world.
But that implies an investment in in that person that you're looking at. And that investment takes time, commitment, and money. And perhaps the situation that we find ourselves in at the moment is people don't have the time, the commitment, and more importantly, the money to deal with these individual cases. Again, it is far easier to lump them all together, to put them in a prison, to put them in a system, to take them from one institution, put them into another institution, to make them institutionalized because of a prison sentence or whatever you do with them.
Well, of course, you're right. It's much easier not to treat people very nicely. It's much easier just to punish people than it is to do something decent to them. But, you know, when you think about someone you love, you're always going to try to treat them decently. And one of the ironies from my life was, you know, I've always worked for charity. I've always worked for nothing, in the sense that the charities, you know, we never get, you don't get paid to do death penalty cases. And so I've spent a massive amount of my life trying to work out who my clients are and what I can do that's best for them, which is a great privilege. I love doing it. I mean, don't get me wrong. But I didn't do that for my dad. And actually, it's not as hard as you're suggesting. I totally take your point. People think it is. But that's because we're all on this, you know, rat wheel that we're going round and round, and we're not pausing to think what we can do. And actually, if we all were to look around us at those we love and say, well, you know, how can, instead of being pissed off at this person, how can I work with them to make their life a bit better? With my dad, just to give an example, my dad would have actually been good at what I do because he just loved arguing with everyone. But the other thing that was his massive passion was writing and poetry, and he was really good at it. And if I had engaged with him on that level instead of all the pointless businesses that he was always trying to set up, then we would have had a vastly better relationship if I'd just recognized what it was that Dad really loved in life and would have enjoyed. He would never have been the richest person on earth, but he would have been a huge amount happier, and that's cool.
You found letters, presumably these are letters, poems, writing after his death. I mean, that must have been did you know about the existence of the 3,000 letters or 3,000 pieces of literature, poems, you know, scraps of information?
Do you know, this book's dedicated to my mom, because my mother, who's 95, is a total saint. Because I never could understand, she had the good sense to divorce my dad when I was about 13. But she always looked after him forever. And, you know, whenever you'd ask her why, she'd say this soppy thing about, oh, he's the father of my three children. And anyway, it was really sweet. But I always thought she was pretty deranged herself, that when my dad wanted to send letters to people, including the King of Spain, telling them how to sort out their business, my mother would agree to post them for him because he never had the money for the stamps. And so he would send one incredibly rude letter and say, send this to all these different archbishops and kings and whatever. And my mom agreed to do that for years. And I, you know, I once told her, I said, Mom, you're just facilitating all this craziness. Don't do it. What I didn't realize is she was doing all of this work so she could censor him. And so there's an awful lot. I got a lot of, you know, letters from my dad over the years. And, you know, they varied from one thing to the other, but they're all a bit mad. But what I didn't know were the ones that my mom didn't send to me, which included the article in the Newmarket Journal where my dear father advocated that I should be executed on the spot myself, which I've never quite, you know, I know your profession has varying standards here, but I've never quite understood why the Newmarket Journal published that. But there's so many letters in there that my mother had protected me from, and she's a great hero for that, but she took it all on herself. And the one reason that I did get angry with my dad post-mortem going through all this is he treated her so badly. And obviously we can understand that he had his issues, but my mom and my father's sister were just so horribly treated by my dad, and that was really traumatic for them, which was awful.
A call for your public execution aside, what would you say, you know, this book has revealed about your relationship with your father and you know, the described it as the hinterlands of the mind's hinterlands. So just if you can briefly, I mean, has it made you appreciate, understand, comprehend what your father was perhaps going through and where, you know, and how we can treat others who may find themselves in that sort of, well, it's the dark, the far side of the moon, that sort of grey area?
Well, you know, I am my father's son, right? My brother and sister and I were sitting around one day, and my older brother, Mark, was saying, oh, I think I'm going to turn out like Dad. And my sister, who's older than me, also just burst out laughing. And I obviously knew why she was laughing. It wasn't terribly kind of her. She turned and said, nah, it's Clive. He's the one who will turn out like Dad. And I did have an agreement with my sister that if I did go that way, so to speak, she could have me involuntarily sectioned. But I think that the key to that is, looking back on it, is I muddled my way through pure good fortune to something that I could deal with, where I hope I haven't inflicted too much pain and suffering on the people around me. But that ultimately is the lesson I learned from this, is why did I fail Dad? I've spent so much time on other people, my clients, and so little on Dad. And I truly regret that. And I think that we'd all regret that for someone who is the only dad we had. And so, you know, the point of the book is to try to help people move towards, you know, looking at people around them, not as mental illnesses, but rather as individuals who we can figure out what's going to make things work for them.
What do you think your dad would have made of the book?
Oh, boy. Well, I didn't write it while he was alive. And yeah, in a way, I'm sorry, because there's lots of things I wanted to ask him. I didn't write it while his older sister, Jean, was alive, because it caused her so much trauma. Because here was a woman born in 1920 who was brilliant. She read the Telegraph too much, so she would have been another Margaret Thatcher, but she would have been a brilliant Margaret Thatcher if women were allowed to back then. And my dad got all the opportunities and she didn't, which was awful. So I didn't want to write it while she was alive. It would have hurt her. Although, again, I regret not being able to ask her things. If my dad had read this book, oh my goodness, the world would have suffered, because he would have taken everything the wrong way. And that's because he had constantly been labeled as an illness, not as a person. And so he wouldn't have seen what I was trying to write. And I would have been so for the high jump. But I hope from whatever place that he's not in now, he would forgive me.
The book is called The Far Side of the Moon, Trials of My Father. It's by Clive Stafford Smith, who we've been speaking to today. Clive, I know I haven't been able to get you that cricket 11 that you wanted.
Can you play? I mean, are you coming to play?
I'm an impact player. People wonder what on earth I'm doing out there. How's that for an answer? The book is called The Far Side of the Moon, Trials of My Father. It's by Clive Stafford Smith, who we've had the great pleasure of speaking to today. Clive, if people want to find out more about you or follow you on the social media, I know you're on Twitter because I've just started following you. So where can people find you?
Well, it is Clive S. Smith on Twitter, but also the 3DC at, it's 3dc.org.uk. So that's the number 3 and then little D and C. That's the new nonprofit I've got. And I'd love anyone who wants to volunteer to be exploited by me to help people in these cases. I'd love to hear from you.
The 3dc.co.uk is the
.org.uk, sorry.
.org.uk is the website to find that. This book is called The Far Side of the Moon. Clive Stafford Smith, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.